It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Democratic National Committee is turning to corporations to fund the party's convention in Milwaukee next year, despite many presidential candidates saying they're swearing off corporate money. We'll look at how that's all playing out in just a bit. First, economists have a big role in American life and policy. They're a key part of the decision-making process in many cases, and their research and philosophies can influence a lot of decisions on a wide variety of topics: climate change, consumer safety, the military draft back in the day, and more. But our next guest says things weren't always that way, and that some of the big predictions from the most influential economists of recent decades haven't really panned out. Benjamin Applebaum writes about economics and business with the New York Times editorial board. He's the author of the new book, The Economist's Hour: False Prophets, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. Benjamin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's hard to imagine, but you describe a time five, six decades ago where economists were sort of, locked away in the basement and nobody really paid attention to them. Can you talk about those days?
Yeah. My book actually opens with the story of a young economist working in the bowels of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He's basically employed as a human calculator. His job is just to do the numbers for the people who actually make the decisions. And he comes home one night and tells his wife that he doesn't see any chance for an economist to make a career at the Federal Reserve. And he's not wrong. At that time, there are no economists in the leadership of the Federal Reserve. The head of the Fed at that time actually tells a visitor that he has a couple of economists that he keeps in the basement because they ask good questions, but they don't know their own limitations. It's a very different time. Well, that young economist's name is Paul Volcker, and by the end of the 1970s, he's running the Fed. And today, the Fed is the nation's largest employer of economists, so there's been this profound transformation.
What led to that transformation? Why did we think of economists as sort of, okay, good questions, but that's all they got, to putting them in charge of the levers of the economy in many cases?
There's a couple different things going on. The first is that after World War II, the government starts to get big and complicated. We're taking on more and more stuff, doing more and more things, and economists are employed basically to help figure out how to do it. They have this sort of rational approach to problem solving, and they're needed to sort of just sort everything out. The other big thing that happens is that the economy starts to falter. By the late 1960s, the period of prosperity that follows the Second World War is starting to come to an end, and there's a lot of concern about how to get things going again. And policymakers go looking for answers, and a new generation of economists basically says, we have an answer. We can restore prosperity, and that is tremendously appealing.
You focus in on a lot of different big-name economists and lesser-known names as well, and different policy debates, but you start and end with one key argument, and that's that while advice from economists helped us in many ways, it also went too far. You say we put a lot of things on the table, we pay attention to a lot of things, but we ended up with a lot of inequality in this country as a result of a lot of the economic decisions that were made. Why is that?
Yeah, so, the big figure in this revolution, the most important figure, is Milton Friedman. And his advice to government on almost every question is pretty much always the same. Get government out of the way. He thinks that markets are just better at allocating resources than our bureaucrats, and that public policy can be improved essentially by doing less public policy. And he and his peers specifically warn policymakers that if you're trying to mitigate inequality, if you're trying to equalize opportunity or to redistribute the gains from the economy, it's going to interfere with economic growth. It's going to slow down growth. And so they tell policymakers, listen, focus on making the pie as large as possible, and don't worry so much about how large each individual piece of the pie may be. And so for the last 40 years, from the late 1960s through the financial crisis in 2008, you really see policymakers taking their eyes off of inequality, no longer treating it as a central issue. And the consequence of that is that inequality explodes because we stopped taking it seriously as a problem. It became a much larger problem.
Stepping outside of the book for the moment, some of your recent reporting has looked at some of the consequences of that. You recently, I think, co-wrote a piece on people who are finding themselves working two or three jobs to keep up with their day-to-day needs. Can you talk about how those individual stories fits into the big story you tell in the book?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, this is the wealthiest nation on earth and the most prosperous nation on earth. But the measure of a society is not life at the top of the pyramid. It's life all the way through the pyramid. And what we see in America increasingly is that the gains from this wonderful economy end up in a very few hands. And meanwhile, the great mass of the population is working really hard just to maintain their standards of living and keep what they have. And you've got a growing share of Americans who need to work multiple jobs to make that happen. You know, we talked to a woman who works during the day at Burger King, and at night she works at McDonald's, and she needs to do both of those jobs just to pay the rent and to keep her kids under a roof and fed. That's tough. When working 40 hours a week is not enough to take care of your children, that suggests that you've got a system that's not producing good results for a lot of people.
We're talking to Binya Applebaum. His new book is called The Economist's Hour: False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. Another theme that keeps coming up is it seems like a lot of economists and the politicians who listen to them settle on one big solution that they apply as a universal, like tax cuts are always good, or government spending is always good, more regulation is good, more regulation is bad. Do we just settle into an orthodoxy and use it as a key to open locks that it doesn't always fit?
I think one thing that clearly has happened during the period that I describe in my book is that economists were addressing genuine problems in the economy. Things really were breaking down by the late 60s, the early 70s. Listeners who are old enough to remember that period will remember that both unemployment and inflation were increasing simultaneously, a phenomenon that was called stagflation, and that really seemed quite scary. Back then, the bogeyman was Japan rather than China, but there was this sense that the United States was falling behind its economic rivals. And there really was a need for new approaches. And so the economists come in with some clear ideas about how to do that. And some of those ideas are genuinely beneficial. So, for example, they deregulate the airline industry, and we all fly more and more cheaply as a consequence. But they kept going with the same ideas. They kept pushing them past their logical limits, insisting that, you know, if some tax cuts were good, then more tax cuts were better. And the result of that sort of, it's a story of a revolution that went too far, basically, as revolutions often do. And the result of that was that it stopped working and started hurting.
One thing that surprised me, because I wasn't really active and aware in the day, but one of the biggest supporters of some kinds of deregulation, including airline deregulation, was Ralph Nader, who you think of as a voice for more regulation in other ways. Regulation meant a lot of different things, didn't it?
So the primary form of federal regulation headed into the 1960s was what was called economic regulation, which means that the government was basically setting prices and setting the rules of business for large swaths of the economy. The airline industry is a great example. There was a board of bureaucrats that met in Washington. If you wanted to fly from, say, Chicago to St. Louis, you needed to go get a license from the government. The government decided how much you could charge for a ticket. The government even decided what types of food you could serve on the planes. It was an extremely prescriptive regulatory state. And Ralph Nader and a lot of people, including Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter, played key roles in this process, basically looked at that system and said, this is not working. We're making it more expensive to fly. We're limiting the ability of people to fly. We want to get rid of that system. Now, during that same period, you've got essentially the same people advocating for the rise of a different kind of regulation focused on health and safety. And so what you see is at the beginning of the 1970s, the majority of federal regulators are involved in regulating prices. And by the end of that decade, the majority of federal regulators are focused on health and safety issues.
Are there key points in the story you tell where you think the inequality we were talking about earlier really took off? Key decision points that turned us in this direction?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that's really remarkable about this period is the way that all of these decisions aggregate to create this problem. But you know, two big things that I would highlight. The first is that the federal government in the mid-century did some really important things, and not just the federal government, but state and local governments too, did some really important things to ensure equality of opportunity, specifically investing heavily in education. And when you're providing good, cheap education to everyone, it means that everyone has a chance to learn, build a career for themselves, and get ahead. We've significantly reduced our investment in education, particularly state university systems have been substantially defunded. And the result is that people have less opportunity to get ahead. And then at the other end of the spectrum is, you know, once everybody's earned their money, how much of it do they need to share with the rest of the people in the community? That's taxation. And there's been this huge shift in taxation. It used to be that the wealthiest Americans paid significantly larger shares of their income in taxes than did less affluent Americans. What we now have is essentially a flat tax. When you aggregate all of the different forms of taxes that we pay, state, local, federal, and add it all up, it turns out that the poorest Americans and the wealthiest Americans are paying roughly the same share of their income in taxes. And so that system is no longer weighing against inequality.
We're talking to Binya Applebaum, author of the new book, The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we've relied on economists too much? Do you have a question for our guest about key policy issues and how economists over the last 4 or 5 decades have dealt with them? Should there be more non-economist voices weighing in on public policy debates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Binya Applebaum about his new book, The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our guest is telling a story of the rise of economists to, in many cases, decision-making power or at least a serious influence in our society. Do you think that's mostly been a positive, a negative, a little of both, if you want to split that up, as our guest does? Do you have questions for our guest about how economists have influenced public policy and our lives in many ways? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Binya, one way public policy led by economists have influenced our lives is they put a value on our lives. And you write about how we assess the value of a human life for decision making. Tell that story.
I think it's a fascinating story. You know, when we're making a decision about whether or not the government should impose a certain kind of regulations, say people are dying in crashes when their cars roll over and the government is considering whether to make auto companies install stronger roofs on vehicles, the way that we now do that is we tally up, you know, the costs of doing that, which are fairly easy to calculate, however much it costs to put those stronger roofs on. And then the government compares that cost with the benefit, which is typically a certain number of lives that it expects will be saved each year. Well, in order to make that comparison, you need to put a value on life. And what economists developed during this period was a methodology for doing that, a way of assessing how much a life was worth. The number that they most commonly use now is around $10 million per life. And so if you multiply that by the number of lives you're going to save and compare it to the cost of the roofs, you can make a judgment about whether or not to go ahead with that regulation. So this is an example of the ways in which economics has just become absolutely central to the business of governing and making these kinds of choices. We have, of course, always made those choices implicitly. The decision about whether to put stronger roofs on cars is inherently a decision about how much money to spend on protecting people from potential injury or death. What economists did was they made that choice explicit. They created a methodology, and they became the people who basically were in the position to make these determinations because they control the rules of the game.
And in one case, I think it was a survival suit used by fishers and divers for the oil industry. There was an argument, if people die, that's okay. The lawsuits will come in, and then that will regulate the market in the right way. That would be better than regulating the suits up front.
What you see in some instances throughout this period, more and more really as the period rolls forward, so from the late 1960s on forward, is you see people developing greater and greater faith in the power of markets and coming to doubt more and more that government has a role to play as a regulator. So, you know, on through the Reagan administration and through the Clinton administration, you see basically this faith that if markets are just left to their own devices, if people are just allowed to do business with each other, it'll all work out for the best. That was, you know, what happened in financial markets, where regulators basically stood back and said, you know, if people want to take out bad mortgage loans, we're going to let them because they must know what they're doing. And it was true in the example you mentioned, which is, you know, these suits that were put out there. So if people were working on oil rigs in cold water, these suits were designed to essentially protect them if they fell into the water. And in some cases, it proved that the suits were flawed. They had holes in them, which meant that the people who entered the water might freeze and die quite quickly. And federal regulators basically looked at that situation and said, you know what, I don't think we need to intervene here. If there's a problem, you know, the people who are using the suits and the people who make the suits, they can go to court and sort it out amongst themselves. That's an example of this mentality that became so pervasive, this idea that government, that markets worked better without government involvement, that the role of regulation was basically to make things worse, and that government was the problem, in Ronald Reagan's famous phrase. And that sense really became pervasive and did a lot of harm.
Let's bring on a caller now. Steve is with us in Lake Mills. Steve, hi.
Thanks, Rob. My question pertains to Scott Walker, and who was he listening to in the divide and conquer, you know, the solutions for Act 10? It seems like he was blaming teachers because they had benefits, i.e. a pension, and Joe Public had nothing, therefore everybody should have nothing. And then he also rams through right to work. My question is, who was he listening to, and who won and who lost there?
Steve, thanks for the call. So, Binya, right-to-work policies and cutting benefits for public employees, is that part of the story you're telling?
It absolutely is. You know, one of the premises of The Economist, who became so influential, was that people basically got paid what they deserved. That you didn't need, that unions and other forms of collective bargaining were basically cartels that were messing with the natural operation of the marketplace and allowing workers to take home more money than they basically deserved, and that we'd all be better off without unions. We'd all be better off if workers just, you know, had to negotiate individually with their companies, because they'd almost naturally make what they deserved, and the world would be a better place. And so that premise that unions were a problem, a perversion of the marketplace, really informed the opposition to unions and led a lot of states to adopt these laws that essentially make it very difficult for unions to organize by allowing workers to decide individually to refrain from being a part of the union. That's had a really that's made it very hard for unions to mobilize and to build support and to bargain collectively. And it's one of the reasons that worker pay has stagnated, is that workers have lost a lot of power relative to their employers. It's become much harder for them to win pay raises in the marketplace.
Talking to Binya Applebaum, author of The Economist Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go to Pepin now in Milwaukee. Pepin, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I just have a point about the whole trickle-down economics, horse barrel, whatever you want to call it, however you want to repackage it. And, you know, they always say, okay, if you lower the taxes, we're going to raise the wages, we're going to reinvest in the economy is going to grow. And what always ends up happening is they end up pocketing the money. So it's like, we shouldn't be surprised if corporations just maximize profits if we don't put any stipulations, you know, concerning tax cuts.
Pepin, thanks for the call. Binya, trickle-down economics he's talking about.
Yeah, so this is, you know, one of these sort of central revolutions in American economic policy, where it used to be the case, as I said earlier, that, you know, we taxed the richest Americans at very high rates. They had to give to the government a very large share of their income. And some economists began to argue in this mid-century period that those rates were so high that they were basically discouraging rich people from working and from investing and from contributing to the economy. And it may have been true that at that level of rates, there was some deterrent effect. You could argue about whether it was worthwhile to prevent people from getting that rich. There may have been some social utility in preserving equality, but there may have been some loss of economic activity as a result. And these economists argued that if you were trying to get the economy going again, you should stop worrying about inequality, focus on economic growth, and that you could get more growth by reducing taxes. So, you know, beginning in the late 1970s, we start to get what are called supply-side tax cuts, first under Jimmy Carter, and then much larger supply-side tax cuts under Ronald Reagan. And what we learn very quickly is if there's any benefit, it's pretty small. And then we keep cutting rates and keep cutting rates and keep cutting rates. And what you basically are doing is you're giving money to the rich and exacerbating inequality. We've run this experiment three times now, in the early 1980s, in the early 2000s, and during the current administration. Each time there have been big claims and promises about all of the economic benefits that will result from lower tax rates, and they've just simply failed to materialize.
Thanks for that call. In our last couple of minutes, Binya, I want to talk about today a little bit. You have kind of an end point on the economist's hour. You think it may be waning in some ways. How so?
I think that the crisis in 2008 is really an inflection point. It was a moment when people looked around and said, hey, what we're doing isn't working. We need to consider other options. Just like in the 1930s and the 1970s, there's a sense that the economic policies that we were pursuing in the previous generation have outlived their usefulness and need to be rethought. And the question is, where do we go from here? And one option, which President Trump has advocated, is that we should, you know, essentially embrace a form of economic nationalism where we, you know, put up tariff walls and try to rebuild domestic manufacturing and take other measures that basically treat other nations as our rivals in a game of trying to compete for economic welfare. That approach, doesn't have a good history. There are other possible approaches as well, but there's a lot of ferment right now, a lot of competing ideas. I think this presidential election is going to, you know, revolve around an airing of some of those competing visions of where we go from here. But it seems pretty clear that the era of just blindly trusting in markets and in the economists who advocated for those markets has come to an end.
Binya, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Binya Applebaum, economics writer with the New York Times editorial board. He joined us today to talk about the rise and maybe fall of economists in American society. His new book is called The Economist's Hour: False Prophets, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts and reactions to what our guest had to say. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up after the news, we'll look at how the Democratic National Committee is trying to fund its convention in Milwaukee next June, some controversy between some of the ways they're trying to do that and what we're hearing from some presidential candidates. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as lawmakers criticize President Trump for pulling U.S. troops from parts of northern Syria, Trump is defending the move, saying he's not abandoning Kurdish allies. We'll look at America's role in the region and how the decision is playing out in Congress. First, the Democratic Party will host its national convention in Milwaukee next June, an event that's expected to cost about $70 million. The effort to raise that money is already underway. Party officials are courting lobbyists and corporate donors, as well as union groups, for contributions. That's a departure for many Democratic presidential candidates who say they're refusing to take corporate money in their campaigns. Maggie Severns is a reporter covering money in politics and the 2020 election for Politico. Maggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, these conventions, these party conventions, they are expensive affairs. That part of this is nothing new, right?
Yeah, I mean, they are expensive. This year, the DNC, as well as folks in Milwaukee, are aiming to raise $70 million overall for next summer's convention in Milwaukee. At points, they have been scaled back, so it's not necessarily that expensive, but they're certainly big-ticket events.
And who are DNC leaders reaching out to right now to try to raise that money?
Yeah, so the early outreach, though it isn't really that early, has started and really kicked into high gear in Washington in recent weeks. And folks over at who are hosting the convention and putting it on have been holding a series of meetings with lobbyists, with corporate clients, asking them to be reaching out to their clients and considering these donations, which can reach up to the hundreds of thousands of dollars to the DNC. And in exchange for those donations, they get packages that give them access to the convention. So hotel rooms, tickets, in some cases VIP tickets, boxes at the convention. So it's a kind of, early corporate sponsorship for the events. Corporations also can sometimes host other, you know, parties and events around the convention. There's also been some outreach to labor unions, which are another, you know, major sponsor. Millions of dollars will also come from labor unions to help do this event. So there's been, you know, some of the really big players are starting to get involved out here in Washington.
And you write that at least it sounds like the goal is to get as much of this money as possible locked down really early. So it's not they're not fundraising in the few months leading up to it. Is that right?
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, you know, planning and organizing and putting on something like this, they've started hiring staff. They've, you know, there's payroll, there's organizing venues. They, you know, people are looking at how do we choreograph everything from hotel rooms to moving buses to shuttle people. So you really want to get money in the door early. And there's this kind of extra dynamic going on this cycle where there's a tension between candidates who are not accepting corporate PAC money and the DNC that is raising or seeking to raise millions of dollars, you know, well over $10 million, though the exact figures are not public, from corporations. So there's also this element where the DNC has been telling lobbyists and corporate donors, hey, you know, the money that you give us, we're going to spend it and we're going to spend it early on the convention, regardless of who the nominee is, which is an interesting dynamic because earlier this week, even Bernie Sanders came out with a plan saying that he does not want any corporate sponsors behind the convention. And if he were to emerge as the early, you know, and likely nominee, he wouldn't want the DNC accepting that money later on.
Right. It seems like there's a fear, as you write, among DNC officials that they're doing all this work at fundraising and they might end up with a candidate who says bad things about it or even says, no, no, send it back.
Yeah. And they're trying to really draw this firm line at this point that says there is no spending it back. You know, that we're spending it now and the money is not going to be returned. I think the big question is going to be, what if we're, you know, 2-3 months from the convention and we have a nominee that says, I'm fine having a smaller convention. I don't need a big corporate, you know, corporate sponsored boxes and huge parties and all the glitz and glamour. I want this money returned, you know, because this could potentially be a clash between the potential nominee and the DNC. On the other hand, you know, we haven't heard from a lot of candidates on their feelings on this issue. You know, someone like Joe Biden, you don't really know if he is a more moderate candidate, is really going to draw a line in the sand that way.
Talking to Maggie Severns, reporter covering money and politics in the 2020 election for Politico. We're talking about the Democratic National Convention scheduled next year in Milwaukee and the fundraising for that convention. Milwaukee, Maggie, the smallest city the Democrats have had their convention in for a bunch of years. Does that create unique challenges for planning and fundraising for a convention like this?
Yeah, it's the smallest city that Democrats have held in several cycles, and the DNC is working really hard to get some planning done early and choreograph things really carefully. But I think in our reporting, we also heard some concerns from people that it's going to just be really challenging. You know, I think that people in Milwaukee took note several weeks ago when there was an announcement from the DNC that state delegations would be staying as far away as Chicago O'Hare in hotel rooms when they came to Milwaukee. That's, you know, an hour and a half drive without traffic. So I think that's just a reflection of how many people, I think, you know, 70,000 people coming into the city and how few hotel rooms. You know, another concern I think was a lack of union hotels in the area. There are 4 union hotels in Milwaukee. There are, one of them is very small. One of them is not full service. So, you know, people are going to be coming in and going late at night. So that really leaves them with 2 places to put up unions who are huge donors to the convention. So it's a massive jigsaw puzzle. You know, when you have people staying really far away and tons of buses coming into the convention center, you have to figure out a place for all those buses to go. There are very frequent organizing calls and things that the DNC is trying to do to make sure that everything goes off well when it happens. But I think it's just adds a layer or several layers of complexity to be using a small city that doesn't do as many conventions. You know, on the other hand, I think that people are looking to Milwaukee to really make a statement. about where Democrats see this election going, about reclaiming Trump territory, and about how they can win in the Midwest.
Right. And that's part of the decision making process about Milwaukee, right? A state that Democrats narrowly lost in the last presidential election. It sounds like Democrats are willing to accept a smaller size and the challenges that entails to have this as the backdrop for their convention.
Yeah, I mean, at least the people who helped, you know, do the ultimate selection of the convention site did. You know, other choices were Miami and Houston, and they decided that they wanted to go with Milwaukee. And, you know, that really, that both kind of makes a statement about wanting to be in a state that Trump won, but it also, there are some structural and strategic advantages to being there. You know, there's a lot of organizing that goes on around a convention, and Democrats can take that organizing and try and parlay it into a ground game in 2020 to try and take back Wisconsin.
We've got a long way still to go before, well, people even start voting, much less we have the convention. What are you watching for next, Maggie, on this story?
You know, on this story, I think it's going to be interesting to see if the DNC does release any information on how much money it's raising. I think it's going to be interesting to see if other candidates come out and say, you know, I don't want corporate money at my convention either. So, you know, we're both kind of looking to see how is this convention coming together and looking to see how are the politics evolving around this convention? You know, is there further tension around this issue of corporate money? Because it's something that Democrats see as really, it's not just about kind of corporations. It's about Democrats really wanting to run on a strong anti-corruption, you know, I'm going to clean up Washington message. And that's something that they really see as, you know, really the heart of their message against Trump. And never has that been more important than with impeachment now going on in Washington.
Maggie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Maggie Severins is a reporter covering money in politics and the 2020 election for Politico. She joined us to talk about how the Democratic Party is working to fund their national convention in Milwaukee next June. Coming up, we'll look at the rift between President Trump and members of Congress, including Republicans, over his decision to move U.S. troops from parts of northern Syria. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet a longtime Milwaukee pastor who served a congregation in Birmingham, Alabama, in the middle of the civil rights movement. Now, President Trump is responding to critics of his decision to redeploy remaining U.S. troops in northern Syria. In a tweet this morning, Trump said, quote, "In no way have we abandoned the Kurds," end quote. But Republican and Democratic members of Congress say that's exactly what Trump is doing by letting Turkey apparently move into the area. Trump echoed a threat he made yesterday that if Turkey attacks the Kurds, the U.S. will destroy Turkey's economy with sanctions. Meanwhile, Trump has invited Turkey's president to Washington for meetings next month. President Erdogan has reportedly accepted. Josh Wingrove is a White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot of twists and turns in the last day or so on this, Josh. What, at least initially, did it appear the president was doing here?
Well, you know, it kind of dropped out of nowhere on Sunday, and he had a call with President Erdogan of Turkey then, and they just sort of announced it, and it caught a lot of people off guard. There's, in fact, no indication that he talked to any senators, any members of Congress about this issue. They say he consulted with state and with you know, officials in the White House, but he essentially is arguing that they've tried to hold off Turkey for, you know, long enough, and they're no longer able to do that, and so they're pulling out about 50 special forces, U.S. special forces, who are in the relevant region of northern Syria to sort of keep them out of harm's way. The flip side of that is the presence of those forces was largely what was deterring the Turks from going in the first place. So it's being read as a tacit sort of encouragement for the Turks to go in, but the White House is trying to stress that they don't endorse this at all, but their moves may be making it more likely.
Now, it's complicated. Turkey is an American ally via NATO. The Kurdish forces have been huge American allies in Iraq and in Syria in the battle against ISIS. The fear is that if Turkey moves forces in and this incursion to this part of Syria, what is the worst case that people are worried about here?
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, the message that it sends to allies. The Kurds fought alongside the Americans and did a lot of the heavy lifting when it came to the fight against ISIS. And if they sort of get the fear among some critics that they'll be essentially left to slaughter at the hands of Turkish forces, and that doesn't send a great message. Then the other question is sort of the more logistical question. There are captured ISIS fighters in this region, and part of the thing Trump announced is that the Turkish government would be responsible for them. But if you are the Kurdish forces, you might have to divert soldiers away from prisons to fight the Turks, and maybe there's a breakout or something like that. You know, so there's a question of, will they be able to sort of keep and continue to detain these captured ISIS fighters, and what happens if any of those fighters break free? And I should note also that this is an unusual thing. You know, Washington is gripped every day with fighting between Republicans and Democrats. The people that are really speaking out here are Republicans, and in particular Republicans who are almost always supportive of President Trump. This is not sort of the three squeaky wheels or so. It's people like Mitch McConnell, it's people like Lindsey Graham, Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador of President Trump. You know, it's Trump's friends that are asking him to reconsider this, not his foes.
I want to listen to one of the names you just mentioned there, Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham. As you say, generally lately a very strong supporter of President Trump. Here he is yesterday morning on Fox News.
This impulsive decision by the president has undone all the gains we've made, thrown the region into further chaos. Iran is licking their chops. And if I'm an ISIS fighter, I've got a second lease on life.
So very strong reaction there from a strong ally of President Trump, as you were just saying.
Yeah, golfing partner of President Trump. I really can't stress how rare it is for Lindsey Graham these days to go against President Trump on that. On the flip side, other senators like Rand Paul are happy with this. I think it's important to keep in mind the president's mindset. He complains all the time of what he sees as endless wars. And so he's looking for ways to get out. He wants out of Syria. He wants out of Afghanistan. You know, he just doesn't see this as particularly useful of American time, money, and manpower. But on the flip side of that, what people are warning is that it risks throwing away the gains. It risks allowing ISIS to sort of take hold somehow, maybe again. And again, you're emboldening Turkey, which, while a fellow NATO member, isn't exactly, you know, best friend of the United States. And of course, many critics are drawing also questions about the business connections of President Trump's private business, which includes Turkey. So there's a lot of moving parts on this one, but really you have President Trump's sort of, you know, natural instinct to get the heck out of these wars coming up against advice from allies saying, you know, can we just pump the brakes on this one for a minute?
Let's give a listen to President Trump talking yesterday about this decision to move these troops in Syria.
We've been there for many years, long, many, many, many years beyond what we were supposed to be. Not fighting, just there, just there. And it's time to come back home. But I can understand the other side of it. But if you go by the other side, that means we should never, ever come home. We should never, ever come home.
But the 50 or so troops in that area, they're, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, they're not coming home. They're just being redeployed elsewhere in the region. Do I have that right?
Yeah, correct. And elsewhere in Syria specifically. So, no, they're not coming home. But President Trump has in the past, but a year or so ago, announced suddenly again a sort of full withdrawal from Syria. And, you know, the fear always in all these cases is that if America goes into some a region to, you know, try to stabilize it, I suppose, is that a quick exit creates a power vacuum, and power vacuums tend not to lead to the kind of stability that that America was going in there in the first place to create. So I think in the past, as I said, tried to like yank, you know, most or all of American forces out of Syria, and, you know, that hasn't happened. And the reason that hasn't happened is, I guess, because he ultimately turns back and listens to his own military leaders and advisors who say that a quick exit would, you know, undo all the work that's been done so far.
Talking to Josh Wingrove, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, about the president's announcement that he would move troops from a key area of northern Syria apparently allowing Turkish forces to move in, raising concerns about the fate of Kurdish forces and citizens there and at the hands of Turkey. Josh, you mentioned congressional criticism of the president from Republicans. We've also seen a statement from Wisconsin's Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican, who said in a press release it's in America's national security interest to stay in the region. A lot of words from Congress. Is there any action to restrain the president or restrain Turkey in Congress right now?
Well, Senator Graham and others are advancing possible sanctions on Turkey that, you know, sort of an end run around kind of the president if Turkey were to go in to northern Syria. President Trump himself yesterday appeared to walk back his statement, saying that he would bring sort of great economic devastation to Turkey if they did something that, in his judgment, his great wisdom, he put it, was offside. What that could be and what that entails, we don't know. So it's a little bit up in the air. But there are, you know, let's remember the landscape here. Trump is commands strong support from Republican lawmakers, or has, but there are signs of fatigue emerging. You know, we see this with the impeachment process that's ongoing. Just today, Trump met with some of his most staunch defenders in Congress, who were wondering why they were left out of the loop when some testimony today was abruptly canceled without them knowing. So any president has to be careful not to totally alienate the congressional side of their party. Trump has, consistently been able to command pretty high support among his congressional wing of the Republican Party. But I think there's a lot of fracture points emerging right now that I think he undoubtedly will be conscious of.
That initial White House statement, people read that as giving Turkey the green light to move forces into the region we're talking about. That there have been mixed messages on that, tweets from the Pentagon and then deleted tweets and then different statements from President Trump. Is the impression still that President Trump is saying, yes, it's OK for Turkey to move its forces across the border into this part of Syria?
Yeah, I think, well, the White House in a briefing yesterday said we do not endorse Turkey going in there. So they, you know, in their view, they're not blessing this. But the act of paving the way in the eyes of others effectively blesses it. You know, it would be difficult to imagine that Turkey would move in against American wishes and into a region where American forces are present. You know, you've got the president saying, hey, don't do this, but he's also clearing people out to sort of create a path for the Turks to go in. So, you know, they're trying to straddle this line of saying, hey, Trump is, I should say, President Trump is trying to straddle this line and say, hey, I don't endorse this, while taking actions that make it a lot likelier that that's going to happen. You know, the statement on Sunday night, which again is not a terribly normal time to set up stuff of this gravity, it sort of really caught everyone by surprise. It said that the United States Armed Forces will not support or be involved in the operation, and that United States forces will no longer be in the immediate area. That kind of gets to the nut of the issue. They're saying they're not supporting the operation, either logistically or philosophically, but also they're not in the region, and taking U.S. troops out of that region is kind of an invitation for the Turks to go in.
And now all this is happening, and there's apparently a meeting coming up between President Trump and Turkey's President Erdogan. What do we know about that at this point?
Yeah, that's going to be, I believe, in November. This was reported in Turkish media, and Trump confirmed it in a tweet today. So Erdogan will be coming here to Washington to visit with the president. Now, this obviously will be top of mind, but there's other issues, too. Remember, the U.S. has recently suspended Turkey from the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program because Turkey bought Russian missiles, defense missiles. So Turkey has always historically straddled the line between sort of Russian influence in the West, but in particular lately is flirting more with the Russians. So, you know, Trump fancies himself a deal maker. I suppose he will try to maybe make some kind of deal that wraps all this up when Erdogan visits. He likes face-to-face meetings in this regard. But, you know, there's a lot of people on Capitol Hill and elsewhere who will say that Turkey is not top of the list when it comes to allies, and giving them a tacit blessing to go into northern Syria could come back to bite the U.S.
And very briefly, Josh, what's the next piece of the story you're watching for?
Well, we're watching if the Turks go in. If you're sitting in Turkey, you would be just as sort of confused as the rest of us seem to be about where the administration stands. And so if they don't actually proceed, then that's one thing. But if they do go in, then that's going to raise the temperature really quickly.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Josh Wingrove, White House reporter for Bloomberg News. We talked with him about the rift between President Trump and members of Congress over his decision to pull U.S. troops out of a key part of northern Syria. There are a lot of ways to mark the arrival of the fall season. The return of college and pro football and Major League Baseball playoffs, that's a key sign for some people. And of course, the arrival of pumpkin spice everything, from coffee drinks to Oreos to the limited edition pumpkin spice Spam. Here at WPR, we're starting to observe a new fall tradition, the return of the spider story. You see, we have lots and lots of articles up at WPR.org. Some are news stories from our reporters. Some are things like Wisconsin Life pieces. Some are write-ups of interviews we do here on the Ideas Network. And like all your fancy high-tech news outlets, we can see how often those stories get looked at. We get a kind of top 40 list every week or so. Most of the articles on that list are new stuff. That makes sense. But every year around this time, an article from back in 2016 pops up. It's from an interview we did on Central Time about spiders and what they do to get through the winter. That idea came from Amanda Magnus, one of our producers at the time. She was really curious about the spiders. Turns out so are lots of people. Every year around this time, when things start to cool off, people go online to answer that question about the spiders and they stumble across that article. If you're curious, you can check it out yourself. Go to WPR.org or use the WPR app and search for spiders. And pour yourself a pumpkin spice latte and read or listen. And drive up the numbers for that story even further. Spider news you can use. This is Central Time.